The past several months have been chaos for groups that help resettle families in the U.S. That's because of new policies by the Trump administration. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Texas has resettled drastically fewer refugees this year than it has in previous years. The Lone Star State had led the nation in the number of refugee families resettled in the U.S. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports it's also translated into fewer resources for the resettlement program.
Here's how Aaron Rippenkroger from Refugee Services of Texas describes the past several months.
2017 has probably been one of, if not the craziest years in the history of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program, which has been around for decades.
It's been crazy because there's been a lot of chaos. The Trump administration's travel bans, for one, put a wrench in a lot of plans for resettling people who were either in transit or within days of coming to the U.S. before the bans were struck down by the courts. Rippenkroger explains the refugee program has a lot of moving parts, and sudden changes like this can upset a really complex system.
When you do attempt to make sudden adjustments to it, it can have a residual effect for years.
The administration also capped the number of people allowed to go through the resettlement program in the coming years, basically half of what the Obama administration planned. In October 2016, more than 1,000 refugees resettled here in Texas. This past April, just 353 people did. Rippenkroger says that scaling back has definitely been noticeable.
The program is smaller right now. It is.
We were like averaging 60 to 70 clients probably a month, and then this number went down to 30, some like 28, so something like that.
That was Katan Mustafa at the end there. He also works with Refugee Services of Texas. He helps place refugees into jobs here in Austin. Mustafa went through the same process several years ago. He was a translator in Iraq for the U.S. military and later resettled here in Austin. Mustafa says this drastic drop in resettlements is troubling because the need hasn't decreased. He says just a few days ago there was another bombing in Baghdad that killed a lot of people.
Very sad to see that numbers are dropped, because we could save people by letting them come to the United States.
And Rippenkroger says the fact that the U.S. could be doing more is not new.
You know, to be honest, the United States, even at its highest points, is letting in a fraction of refugees as compared to other countries in the world. And we do it very well.
Last year, the state of Texas pulled out of the federal refugee program after a dispute with the Obama administration over background checks. Since then, groups like Refugee Services of Texas have been running the program. For Fronteras, I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Now here's a picture of the U.S. immigrant population. America has more immigrants than any other country in the world, according to the Pew Research Center. More than 40 million people living in the U.S. were born in another country, based on statistics from 2 years ago. That accounts for about one-fifth of the world's migrants. The immigration population in America is also very diverse, with just about every country in the world represented. Most immigrants, 76%, are in the country legally, and 20 million are naturalized. Texas lawmakers ended the regular session of the state legislature without passing a number of bills. One piece of legislation that didn't make it to Governor Greg Abbott's desk would have licensed immigrant detention centers in Texas as child care providers. This was a failed effort to avoid the federal rule designed to prevent the centers from holding immigrant minors for more than 20 days. Yet some Texas detention centers are holding children far longer than the law allows. The Texas Standard's Laura Rice talked with Associated Press reporter Meredith Hoffman about this issue.
So in your story, you highlight a family who's been held at an immigration detention facility in Texas for 6 months. Could you tell us a little more about this family and their journey?
Yes, sure. So it's actually a family from Afghanistan. There's a woman, Samira Hakimi, a 35-year-old with two young sons, ages 4 and 8, and her sister-in-law, and her sister-in-law's now 10-month-old son, who have been held in a facility in Karnes Detention Center since December. And only earlier this month, Samira, who has previously suffered depression, actually attempted to commit suicide in the facility because it was really too much. And the family had fled the Taliban because in Afghanistan, they had been operating schools with a Western-style curriculum and having scholarships both for boys and girls.
What about the legislation that Texas lawmakers were trying to pass this session that would have licensed detention facilities as child care providers? What was the goal there, and does it appear to matter at all that this did not pass?
Well, advocates say that this piece of legislation was intended to prolong the lawful stays of families in detention because a couple of years ago, as you noted, a judge ruled that minors can only be held in unlicensed, secure or locked facilities for up to 20 days. And while these facilities are indeed locked, this could have licensed the facilities and provided an argument that families could have been held in them longer than 20 days.
So immigrant rights activists said this Texas effort was a bad idea, even calling it an idea that would have led to baby jails. Can you tell us a little more about the backlash and why this didn't pass in Texas?
Sure. Well, actually, immigrant activists already call these facilities baby jails. Mm-hmm. I've actually visited Karnes. It is indeed a lockdown facility, hence the reason that people call it a baby jail, because you have children who are stuck inside of it. The bill's authors say that this piece of legislation was designed to help ensure that the detention centers had oversight by the state. Pediatricians, child welfare advocates, a whole host of people have testified that holding children in the immigrant detention facilities causes severe psychological and at times physical damage for the children.
You told us a little bit about the Hakimi family. Do we know how many others have been held in Texas facilities longer than this 20-day limit?
Sure. Well, this year, I've only heard of at least 7 families who have faced this. And actually, when the facilities first started housing families in the summer of 2014 to address an influx of women and children crossing the border to seek asylum from Central American gang violence, the facilities were holding families for up to 10, 11 months. Hmm. So this is not the first time that this has happened, and it is at a much smaller scale than it previously was. However, now it has clearly been deemed a violation of the law.
Do we know what's next for the Hakimi family?
They actually had their asylum hearing earlier this month, so they're awaiting their final decision. So if they do indeed receive asylum, they will finally be released into the United States.
That was the Texas Standard's Laura Rice speaking with Associated Press reporter Meredith Hoffman. An update to this story, Samira Hakimi, the Afghan mother Hoffman mentioned in her interview, was released May 31st along with her two children. The news was announced on Monday, June 5th. Hakimi's sister-in-law and her 10-month-old infant are still being detained. Samira Hakimi has resettled in San Francisco. Turning now to California, where a San Diego agency that provides a lifeline to immigrant and American human trafficking victims is running out of money. La Maestra Community Health Centers provide wellness services to low-income residents, regardless of immigration status. But a 25% cut in funding from the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants has put the program that helps trafficking victims in jeopardy. Taryn Mento of KPBS explains.
In an anti-human trafficking video, an unidentified woman faces away from the camera and explains in Spanish how she was abused by her American spouse. She says her husband, a truck driver, forced her to join him on trips across the country.
I didn't want to go with him because he could do whatever he wanted with me out in the middle of the desert.
She says he'd threaten the lives of her children if she didn't. So she went, and this is where it takes a gruesome turn.
He would bring men inside the truck to rape me to the point I would bleed, but the rape would continue.
Eventually, she managed to escape and join her kids. But her story didn't end there.
She was totally destroyed.
Carmen Kalmt is with the City Heights-based nonprofit La Maestra Community Health Centers. The organization provides wellness services to San Diego's low-income residents, including medical care. Kalmt first met the woman in the video when she sought La Maestra's health services for her son.
And the doctor asked him why he has fever. It was a winter time. And she said, we live in the car. Why you are living in the car? Somebody's following us. So he called me.
Kalmt leads La Maestra's human trafficking program. After hearing the woman's story, she identified her as a victim and immediately got to work. She provided the woman with a monthly stipend, supplied her with donated items, connected her to health and counseling services, and put her on the pathway to residency. The woman's husband purposely didn't seek legal status for his wife, who's from Mexico. Undocumented immigrants who are victims of trafficking are eligible for what's called the T visa. And with 18 months, Comp says the woman received hers and was able to stay in the country.
I still see her all the time. She's doing better now. Of course, you know, those scars in the soul never get well. But the kids are doing well.
Over the last 5 years, Kalmt has helped 90 other victims of labor and sex trafficking in San Diego. Although the majority of victims countywide are U.S. citizens, most of Kalmt's clients are immigrants. She tracks them by placing a pushpin in their country of origin on a large wall map in her office.
We have Japan, Philippines, Mexico is full. That's why we have two extra maps for Mexico.
San Diego is home to a large human trafficking market, says FBI Supervisory Special Agent Todd Hemmen. He says it can be difficult for the Bureau to combat this because most victims who would provide key information stay hidden in the shadows.
We vet every lead that we get. And unfortunately, I think we're missing a lot of these victims because we never get that information.
He says law enforcement agencies often work with organizations like La Maestra to connect with victims, which also increases immigrants' chances of receiving a visa. Comp says all of her current 18 clients are working with either federal or local agencies. Those 18 clients also rely on her agency's cash assistance of $500 to $600 a month while their visas are pending. She says clients often pool this money together to pay for housing instead of possibly ending up in a shelter. But recently, her funding from the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants was reduced, and the rest is in jeopardy.
This is really a problem of success.
That's the committee's president and CEO, Lavinia Limon, speaking via Skype. She says more people are coming forward to access its affiliate services each year. In the past, the federal government has raised the organization's funding, but not this year. It's now facing a $2.5 million gap, which she says will hurt more than just victims.
Because the people we help, they help law enforcement. They testify in trials. They give law enforcement information so the police and, you know, the FBI and everybody can go after these very well connected gangs who do trafficking and make millions of dollars off of it.
While there is a chance existing funding could be shifted and there are several other service providers in the county, Comp says her program could run out of money by the middle of July. In the meantime, she says she can't enroll new clients. There are currently 5 people on her waiting list.
Taryn Mento of KPBS brought us that story. Coming up on Fronteras, Dallas lowriders challenge stereotypes, and an art exhibit examines the mosaic of colors in the human race.
I guess I didn't realize there were so many nuances in the different shades and colors, but I think it's very reflective of the community that I live in.
We'll explore these stories after this. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Houston is the most racially and ethnically diverse metropolitan area in the nation. That's according to the Kinder Institute for Urban Research out of Rice University. Now, an art exhibit exploring the shades of race is on display at Houston's Health Museum. Houston Public Media's Laura Lucas reports on how residents are reacting to the mosaic of colors entitled Human Eye.
When you enter the exhibit Human Eye at the Health Museum, you're overwhelmed by well over 200 images of diverse faces, each image with a series of numbers and letters assigning skin tones with color codes in the Pantone palette. Brazilian artist Angelica Doss intended the photos to be a global exploration on skin tone, but some Houstonians, like Vanessa Rhodes and Flavia Ward, saw a reflection of themselves and their hometown.
And I guess I didn't realize there were so many nuances in the different shades and colors, but I think it's very reflective of the community that I live in.
It's good because I can see people that look like me. I can see people that look like friends and look like my kids. So I think it's amazing.
The ongoing photo series as a whole already contains more than 3,500 images. There are no classifications regarding nationality, gender, age, race, social class, or religion. That stood out to James Wyatt.
Honestly, it makes me think that it's, aside from a name of a label on a Pantone color, we're not a whole lot different. You can use, I guess, a skin color for some fast classification, but ultimately it's just that. It's something on the outside.
The exhibit is open until early September. I'm Laura Lucas.
Lowriders are popular in Latino communities, and North Texas is one place that has a thriving lowrider car culture. Lowriders are large, decades-old vehicles that ride low to the ground. Their candy-colored paint, hydraulic systems, old-fashioned style, and unique designs make them stand out. And as such, the cars and their drivers can attract attention and be associated with negative stereotypes. But as KERA's Jessica Diaz-Hurtado reports, some Dallas lowrider drivers aim to shift those bad vibes out of gear.
I'm going to show you what it's about to be in a lowrider car. We're going to hit rock bottom, okay?
Jimmy Lopez is behind the wheel of his 1972 Buick Riviera, hitting the ground to get low and to go slow. He's restored this classic car. It's long, sleek, and shiny orange. A chandelier sways as he drives through a park in Oak Cliff. These lowrider cars tend to get a bad rap. Just ask the owners.
They stereotype us as gangsters or, you know, lowlives.
Drug dealers.
They're lowriders, they're cholos, and they're trouble.
That's Sofia Barron, Michael Bush, and Sonia Lopez. They're part of the United Lowriders Association. It's a group of car lovers across Dallas-Fort Worth. They formed 15 years ago to create community and to support each other, and to challenge the stereotypes some have about lowriders, stereotypes that are found in movies and TV shows. For Sofia Barron, lowrider culture is more than just cars.
It's about family. It's about us all being together, showing our children what the car clubbing is about. It's really an art. It's an art form. It's a way for you to express yourself. It's a way for you to be able to kind of go and de-stress.
During the week, Barron's a nurse, and on the weekends, she cruises her sporty, bright red Impala. She's loved hot rods and speed ever since she was a kid. Her car is her identity.
It represents you and who you are. It's your personality. It's, you know, it's your history. It's your story.
And this kind of history is passed down. Before they can even drive, kids are welcomed into this culture. They start out with lowrider bicycles, customized bikes inspired by the lowrider cars. This is what Jimmy Lopez started with. He's the leader of the United Lowriders Association. For him, this culture created his love story. It's how he met his wife, Sonia.
I was still in high school. I was 17. She was 16. Well, I had my lowrider bike, and I was trying to get with her and see her, and I didn't have a car then, and so I got on my bike, and
I'm like, it's pretty far.
Rode all the way from North Dallas all the way to Oak Cliff, and then she wanted to go back over there, so I gave her a ride all the way back over there.
So we crossed the levee, and he was pedaling, standing up, and I had to hold my ankles.
She was holding her legs up. Her knees were barely touching the concrete, but we made it.
They also made a family, and they raised their son, Jimmy Lopez IV, in the car culture.
So since I was two or three, I've been riding in his backseat until I grew up and got my own.
He drives his 1985 Monte Carlo convertible. It's bright blue with wavy and red-white stripes. And in the interior, there's a special message.
If you look at my back seat, it says my family comes first. I got that embroidered in my seat.
For the Lopez family, the Lowriders Association is a family. They gather at special events like this one on Easter at Flagpole Hill Park in Dallas. Hundreds of people are hanging out, grilling, and cruising their cars. During the holidays, they organize toy drives for hospitals and the Dallas Police Department. And they organize benefits for cancer patients, something Jimmy Lopez knows firsthand.
My wife had cancer. She's a survivor right now. Well, other car clubs in the ULA got together and they did a car show for us and in honor of us. And everything that was made at that car show went to us. I mean, that's why you do benefits. You help out when you can.
His lowrider family has kept him going. So has his old school Buick Riviera. It's taught him some lessons, that life isn't about speed.
If you see, I don't have no speedometer right here. People always ask me, hey, how do you know how fast you're going? I don't need to know because I'm going cruising. I'm low and slow.
For Jimmy Lopez, life is about taking it slow. With style. Jessica Diaz Hurtado, KERA News.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.